America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. If there's an issue that best symbolizes the partisan doom loop of our politics, it's immigration reform. The issues are years in the making, have had bipartisan remedies advanced, and yet nothing gets done. Not even for the DACA children, who everyone agrees are American by any measure. It's a personal tragedy for many, a political travesty for a once welcoming nation, and a festering problem with political upsides for those who time and again exploit it. We need a reasoned voice to explain what's happening, and we found one. Hear him today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Ali Noorani, and he's written a new book called Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. He is the president and the CEO of the National Immigration Forum, which is an advocacy organization promoting the value of immigrants and immigration. He's written another book called There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. And it's such an important issue, Ali, to talk with you about today. And let me start with a few old canards, which I hear all the time. I hear the one that said, well, you know, I have no problem with immigration, but I'm against illegal immigration.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity. And that is certainly something that we hear over and over and over again, as we've been working on this issue now for nearly 40 years as an organization. And when you start to ask people really what the questions are, what the fears are they have when it comes to immigration, it really boils down to culture, security, and the economy. And these fears, as I wrote about in Crossing Borders, really cut across all sorts of immigration, whether it's, quote, legal immigration, undocumented, or even refugees. What we find is that folks who have legitimate concerns are asking the question, are immigrants, are they integrating and isolating? Are they threats or protectors? Are they givers or takers? So while often the debate is, you know, simplified to one canard or another, it's important to peel back the layer of, you know, the onion, if you will, and really try to understand what people's fears are. And then you can actually have a conversation and put together a strategy of, okay, how do we address these concerns?
Let's go back, though, to America's history and the whole idea that my ancestors, some will say, they came the right way. They had papers. And that's not even true. I mean, when did the federal system of immigration really take, center, as opposed to people really, you know, looking to leave horrendous conditions all over the world to come to the shining city on the hill?
Well, when you look back over the history of the United States, our struggle with managing immigration has gone on for decades, if not quite frankly, centuries. So a lot of our initial efforts to control immigration were really exclusionary. So you actually have the Chinese Exclusion Act in the late 1800s. And you have other pieces of legislation going into the early 1900s. But the first time it was, you know, our nation's immigration system really kind of came to be was the 1924 Immigration and Nationality Act. That was the first time that Congress said, okay, looking around the world, these are the countries that we want immigrants from, and this is how we're going to set up a system that will prioritize one country's population over another. So, you know, by and large, you know, before 1924, there was no immigration system per se. That system, as we, you know, deal with it now, really came together almost, 100 years ago now.
And when we go back to 1965, when there was a determination that we really needed to be more inclusionary and allow people to come from other parts of the world, not just Europe, what did that signal as to a change in the way we looked at immigration?
Well, in 1965, President Johnson signed the Immigration Nationality Act. Now, this was really based on 50 years of work by a number of members of Congress and leaders across the country. First and foremost, I would say, is Emanuel Seller from New York. He was a congressman who actually his first high-profile debate in Congress as a freshman member was in 1924. So some 50 years later, he finally gets to a place where, you know, in 1965, partnering with Congress and other members of Congress in office at the time, you know, said, okay, as a nation, we want to make sure that we are eliminating these strict per country quotas. We are understanding what's the balance between work-based immigration and family-based immigration. And they set up a system, they reformed the system so that over time, we as a nation really saw immigrants not only as workers, but as members of families as well. And that really over time has changed the United States for the better because, you know, now we are, you know, the strongest economy in the world. We have an ability to recruit and to retain talent from around the world who are working shoulder to shoulder with Americans every single day. And it goes back to that 1965 piece of legislation.
There are some who suggest that they're not against immigration per se, but they're worried about terrorists in particular crossing the southern border. Though if we go back, I know that there was a surge in deportations under the Obama administration, but it all really goes back to 1996, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which created these pipeline of deportation. Describe what that process really has meant overall to our immigration policy.
Well, that 1996 piece of legislation was transformative in many, many ways. I think the most transformative effects that it had were actually in Central America in a country like Honduras. So what happened in the States, in particular, let's say Southern California, is that a Honduran youth would be arrested for X, Y, or Z crime. If that youth was undocumented through that 1996 legislation, they would be deported back to Honduras. What happened back in Honduras is that at the same time, you saw drug trafficking move from the routes that would go through South Florida to a route that went through Central America. So that meant that Honduras became a hotspot of drug trafficking, and they had a labor force, which was in essence the U.S. was deporting back to Honduras. So over the matter of less than a decade, you saw the homicide rates in Honduras double, if not triple. And then, lo and behold, what happens is that parents are looking around, seeing their neighborhoods, their communities across Honduras become more and more violent because of the drug trafficking, because of the deportations back to Honduras. They send their children to the U.S.-Mexico border, hoping that they can find protection here in the United States. What this all means is that that 1996 legislation created drug cartels and very powerful violent organizations in Honduras, which then led to a flow of undocumented immigrant youth going from a place like Honduras to the U.S.-Mexico border. And our nation's immigration system was not ready to handle that sort of flow of individuals, which then played into the fears that you mentioned on the part of many Americans who say, who were saying that things are terrible in Honduras. There's all this violence. There's all this drug trafficking. Now we have unaccompanied youth that are here. What are we going to do about them? Because my assumption is that they are here to do harm. When in reality, these youth were being pushed by our nation's deportation policies to come to the U.S. to try to find protection. That is just one example of just the vicious cycle of fear of death, of trafficking that migrants face because, quite frankly, of our nation's broken immigration system.
You talk about changes in the California law, federal laws that helped to build an incubator in California prisons for gangs to develop like MS-13, who could go back to Central America ultimately, and that a lot of violence kind of spilled across both borders. But then we also heard a great uproar about MS-13 during the Trump administration, and that was emblematic of the rhetoric that changed so decidedly during that administration.
You're absolutely correct. So remember in 2015, the summer of 2015, you know, Donald Trump comes down the golden escalator and, you know, announces his campaign for president. And in that speech, he says, to paraphrase, Mexico is not sending their best. They're sending rapists. They're sending criminals. You know, dot, dot, dot. Some of them may be good, maybe okay. But that was the beginning of candidate Trump weaponizing migration, whether it was from Central America and, quite frankly, tagging each and every Latin American immigrant as a member of MS-13, or also weaponizing migration from the Middle East. Because at that very same time, you had the Syrian refugee crisis and these pictures of hundreds of thousands of Syrian families trying to get to Europe, whether it was through Hungary, through Italy, trying to get to the UK or elsewhere in Europe. Or, for example, Germany took in upwards of 1 million Syrian refugees. But Donald Trump was able to weaponize both of these flows of migrants, whether or not they were coming to the U.S., to instill and tap into a level of fear among Republican and, quite frankly, a lot of independent Democratic voters who said, you know what, Donald Trump is the one who's going to secure our borders. When in reality, what happened under the Trump administration is that, yes, you had terrible rhetoric, but the cartels figured out how they could monetize President Trump's immigration policies to then, quite frankly, make billions of dollars on the smuggling of immigrants, because ultimately immigrants had no other option other than to pay a cartel $5,000 to $10,000 in order to try to get to the U.S. for protection.
So that's not really highly reported. People don't understand. I mean, they saw those policies at the border. They saw separated families, a no-tolerance policy. So, I mean, that's what they remember. They see a wall going up. What really happened during that period?
So as I was researching Crossing Borders, I did a couple of trips to Honduras. And one particular trip, I went to the highlands of the country, the La Union region of Honduras. And I remember sitting down with a young man named Carlos. He had a small farm, a small house, three young daughters. And his coffee farm had been hit by a drought, had been hit by two outbreaks of coffee rust. And finally he said, you know what? There's no other option for me here in Honduras. I can't move to the cities because they are crumbling. The best chance that I have is to get to the United States. So he paid us a smuggler $8,000 to get him and his daughter to the U.S.-Mexico border. At the U.S.-Mexico border, the Trump administration told him, you have to remain in Mexico until your asylum case is heard. And this is perhaps one of the most powerful stories that I was told as I was researching the book, is that Carlos told me, you know, he did not lie. He went to the authorities and said, I am only looking for a job to make my life better. And his wife interrupted at that point in the conversation, and she said, we are being punished for telling the truth. And at the end of that conversation, he said, if he had access to an immigrant visa to get to the U.S. and work in construction or agriculture, he would take it in a heartbeat. If the government in Honduras was able to help him and his family, he would have remained in Honduras. But at the end of the day, the only option that he had was to pay that cartel, pay that human smuggling operation $8,000 to try to find a job in the U.S. He didn't want to do that, but he had no other choice. And so when you look at the data, over the course of the Trump administration, for the cartels, this line of business of in essence, you know, serving as our nation's immigration system doubled. I mean, they're making now, you know, upwards of $3-4 billion a year just by, in essence, you know, being our nation's immigration system, which, like you said, I don't think many Americans realize.
What about the ports of entry? You talk about them. The fact that you can build a wall, but then again, if many of the drugs are being smuggled across through ports of entry, are you really looking at the wrong place to put up a barrier?
So when you look at the data from a place, let's say, for example, the Department of Justice, You find that year after year, the majority of guns, drugs, and money are being smuggled through ports of entry. So in the book, I tell the story of, you know, Trump on, I think it was like a Tuesday, at a port of entry in Texas, making a big show of being surrounded by drugs, guns, and money that were captured by Border Patrol. Those drugs, guns, and money were actually captured at a port of entry, as was cited by the New York Times of it at that point in their reporting. But Trump made it sound, he framed it as these terrible things, and immigrants were detained and apprehended all along the port, all along the border, excuse me. Then the next day, he's back in Washington, D.C., in the Roosevelt Room, sitting with sheriffs from across the country. And a sheriff tells the story of a young person in her community who died from a fentanyl overdose. And Trump tries to frame this overdose as a function of a broken immigration system, when in reality, the majority of fentanyl is smuggled through a port of entry, or these days is mailed, quite frankly. So what you saw over and over again is that Trump and his administration would conflate drug smuggling with undocumented immigration, really as a way to deflect attention from a failed strategy in terms of stopping drug flows to a strategy that people could understand, build a wall, get very angry about it, get very angry at immigrants. And Trump was able to, you know, win that, you know, carry that to, you know, multiple kind of policy victories over the course of his administration.
Ali Noorani is with us. The book is called Crossing Borders. When we talk about the issue of immigration that comes from Central and South America, and of course we hear a lot about the Northern Triangle, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, what is Mexico's role in where we are today? How are we changing our relationship? Because I know that our Vice President Kamala Harris has been tasked with really talking to the leaders in the areas that we're talking about, primarily Central America and Mexico. What is Mexico's role in all of this?
Well, I think this fits into a really important long-term trend in terms of how liberal democracies around the world are managing migration. And we first saw this very clearly, at least most recently, in 2013, when the European Union tried to put in place strategies to manage, control, and quite frankly, stem migration from Syria and other parts of the Middle East and South Asia. And what they did is that, you know, really led by Viktor Orban of Hungary, started to externalize their borders. And what I mean by this is that, you know, the EU's furthest border, external border, is, in this case, Hungary. Viktor Orban was able to weaponize that to his political advantage, so that then what happens shortly thereafter is that the European Union says, okay, we can't deal with Viktor Orban anymore as a EU member, so let's leverage Turkey, and let's make sure that Turkey is, in essence, doing everything they can, and we will pay them to do it, to stop immigrants from crossing into Turkey and then into Hungary and the EU. And then they also did that with between Italy and Libya, so that Libya is now paid significant amounts of money and given hardware to stop migration from Northern Africa through Libya and in across the Mediterranean and into the European Union. So the United States approach is beginning to mimic what the EU has done. Trump began this by starting to leverage, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, and other Central American countries and Mexico to mitigate and stem migration from Central and even South America. So to get to your question, the role of Mexico here is incredibly important. You know, they are one of our, if not our largest trading partners. So there is an economic relationship as well as a security relationship. We need to help Mexico develop their own immigration system so they can take in asylum seekers, that they can actually have a trained border patrol. Right now, they just use the military, their military forces to manage their southern border. But ultimately, that's not going to solve the problem because, quite frankly, the cartels will find a way around Mexico or through Mexico. So it comes back to the Congress, the United States Congress, needing to create an immigration system so that Carlos in the highlands of Honduras isn't paying a cartel $8,000 to get through Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico to the U.S. border, but is actually paying for a legal immigration visa, which serves our bottom line economic needs of the country. So, yes, Mexico has a role in all this, but to just treat Mexico as an arm of immigration enforcement is not going to solve the problem.
So when we hear that our vice president is now trying to look at the root causes of the problem, I mean, you tell us that our foreign policy establishment has paid so little attention to Central America. We were so focused on the Middle East and now Asia that we only pay attention to crisis. And yet there are these substantive issues that you talked about at the beginning of our conversation about what's going on in Central America, because you also tell us that immigrants really don't want to leave their homes. They leave it often because it's the last resort, because life there has become so untenable. So how do we really begin to figure out what we have contributed to those root causes or what is endemic in their own systems and work with them to help build a better immigration structure for us? Because we need immigrants. I mean, this is the thing that I think is getting lost in the conversation today. We just lost, 800 plus thousand people to COVID, and we have a mismatch in terms of the elderly, which dominate our economy today, all moving out of the workforce. We need more bodies in America.
You're absolutely right. So Honduras, again, provides a really, really important example here. So in 2004, the Honduran National Police was trusted by 56% of the population in Honduras. By 2012, as corruption and violence really began to move through society in Honduras, and it was clear that, Honduran government was unable to deal with that corruption, deal with that violence, the trust, the population's trust in the Honduran National Police fell to 29%. One of the most important things that I think was done in Honduras was that in 2016, faith organizations came together with civil society organizations under the authority or the mandate of the president of Honduras to create a purge commission. And what they did is they looked at the Honduran National Police from top to bottom and said, okay, we are going to purge the corrupt actors from the Honduran National Police. By 2018, they had removed 4,600 officers, and I'm talking from the leadership to the rank and file. In the same period of time, between roughly 2015 and 2018, the homicide rate in Honduras dropped by 60%. So there are ways to address root causes of violence and corruption. It's very easy to say those are quality of life, measures. That's beyond a quality of life. That life measure, that's a life or death measure in terms of corruption and violence that leads to such high homicide rates. But there are strategies that can be put into place that address root causes that then are the foundation to economic development. Under the Trump administration, we saw a collapse in both political and financial support for strategies to address root cause issues in Central America. So now the Biden administration, quite frankly, has to start from scratch in many ways in terms of rebuilding the institutions, rebuilding the strategies so that, like you said, a Central American has the ability, the trust, and the confidence, quite frankly, to stay at home, whether it's Honduras or Guatemala or elsewhere. And that if they do want to come to the United States, that we as a nation have an immigration system that serves our economic and our social needs. Because like you said, we as a country ultimately do need immigrants. And there are ways to set the system up that serve our nation's interests.
Do you see us moving in this direction? I mean, you say very clearly, just so anybody listening doesn't get the impression that you are for open borders, you say that immigration enforcement is necessary, but it should be based on actionable intelligence, not headlines and perceptions. And yet it's been weaponized so much that I don't know how we get to an honest discussion. But having said that, we've had people across the aisle agree that we need immigration reform, but it always gets stalled in a Congress that seems unable to get out of its own way.
It's not going to happen overnight by any means, right? This is going to be a long road to rebuilding support for our nation's immigration system that actually leads to a reform of our immigration system. But that reconciliation of our nation of immigrants begins with the reconciliation of our communities. But I write about Twin Falls, Idaho, which in 2015 was a community that Donald Trump weaponized and agitated, to put it kindly, around the Syrian refugee crisis. The media ecosystem that was supporting Trump focused on Twin Falls and a particular incident there, and really began to make the case that in rural southern Idaho, there was an influx of Syrian refugees that were just doing terrible things. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, in Twin Falls, Idaho, southern Idaho, you have an unemployment rate of approximately 3%. You know, there is a vibrant community of immigrants and refugees from around the world that are supported by everybody, you know, in Twin Falls. But what happened is that conservative dairymen in southern Idaho said, you know what, we have a responsibility based on, yes, our economic needs, but more importantly, who we are as people and their own histories as members of immigrant families to do something about this. So, you know, in southern Idaho, this community led by dairymen who convened the Mormon community, the evangelical community, the Catholic community, local law enforcement, the immigrants and the refugee community to begin to shape a strategy around creating a sense of unity in southern Idaho. And they supported each other and have just done really remarkable things. And I think that if we can find and replicate those kinds of examples across the country, then we get closer and closer to Congress saying, okay, let's put our shoulder to the stone, if you will, here and figure out how we're going to fix our nation's immigration system.
But if we can't even act on DACA, which is something that Donald Trump went back and forth upon, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, where most people, 99%, agree, you know, these kids had nothing to do with the circumstances surrounding how they got here. They are as American as any other children, and they want a great future, and they have such potential for America, and they're right here, and they're not going anywhere. So we haven't been able to deal with them. We haven't been able to deal with their parents and, you know, relatives, and that's about 11, 12. We don't even know, you know, the numbers. Both parties have utilized this issue for so long, you know, one to expel, the other to exploit, either for political purposes or one thing or another. So, you know, both parties really can't look at this issue and say we're blameless in this. So why can't they work together and try to create an opportunity that starts with DACA and moves toward those who are already here and then begins to work on the issues that we see at the border that are used by both parties, and they each tell us one story or another about what's really happening at that border?
That would be a perfectly rational and logical approach, but unfortunately, that is not, those are not the days that we live in.
Okay.
The reason I ended up calling the book Crossing Borders is that so much of what is happening at borders, whether it's our own border with Mexico or borders around the world, is driving how people understand immigration. In fact, I cited a book by Eric Kaufman, who's a researcher out of Oxford in the UK, where he makes the case that people's local experiences around immigration are overshadowed or overpowered by their perception of immigration at a national level. And I would go a step further and say it's even overpowered by their perception of immigration at a global level. So what I'm getting at here is that I think Democrats need to advance strategies and solutions around border security that, number one, keep us secure, and number two, treat us compassionately, and really understand that that is where the majority of the American public is, because that's their perception that this is a border issue, not necessarily a community issue. Republicans, on the other hand, need to really think through, okay, how do they understand that? How do they help their communities, their conservative and moderate communities, see that the Maria or the Jose that they have come to know, respect, and love because they go to church with them is the same person as the Maria or the Jose or the Muhammad at the border, whether it's the U.S. or any other border, is just seeking the same opportunity. And we've got to be able to figure out that how we connect those stories in people's minds. And I think both parties have an opportunity to lean towards each other here a little bit, see that people's perception of immigration is defined what's happening at borders, and we have to be able to change that conversation a little bit.
You talk about a number of things in this book. I mean, there's so much to unpack about this issue. One thing that I found interesting was this growing Protestantism not having the positive effect that perhaps, you know, some might have hoped. In other words, the Catholic Church, which really has been so dominant in our minds, at least in the lives of those in Central and South America. And yet you say there's a growing Protestantism. Explain where religion fits into, you know, our feelings about, you know, the immigration and, you know, bringing refugees across and asylum and all these issues that do get sometimes murky for most of us to understand the difference between an immigrant and an asylum seeker. But explain that to us.
One thing that I've been saying for years is that the immigration debate is not about politics and policy. It's about culture and values. So as an advocate, as an advocacy organization, we really try to understand, okay, who do we need to engage in this conversation, and through what culture, through what values framework do they see immigration? And when you're talking to a conservative community, more times than not, that cultural framework, that values framework is based on one's faith. And in this, most cases with this population, it's Christianity, whether it's, you know, being evangelical or Catholic or mainline. So what we try to do is understand, okay, how are people's religious identity and their political identity being conflated and combined really in a way that has happened because powers such as Donald Trump have been able to weaponize migration. So oftentimes people will talk about Matthew 25, the verse in the Bible on welcoming the stranger. But that particular verse, as good as that makes people feel, it is overpowered by their perception of a border that is out of control, whether it's U.S., Mexico, or otherwise. And Trump and others have been able to lean into that dissonance and create fear within political and religious communities. So the case that I try to make in Crossing Borders is that by understanding and engaging in people's cultural advice framework and their desire to be good people of faith, how can you, you know, shift this conversation so that part of being a good person of faith, part of being a good Christian, is to understand what it really means to be one who welcomes a stranger? And most importantly, how do you create a community so that people who want to do that don't feel like they're alone? And that's the most important and, frankly, the most difficult part about this, because, you know, our religious and our political identities have been twisted up into one thing so tightly. You know, shifting somebody's identity is so much harder than shifting their opinion, because it takes a high level of courage for someone to say, you know what? I am going to disagree with my family or my friends when it comes to immigration, and that's going to make me feel really alone. So what we wanted to do is create community so that these individuals, by and large women, did not feel alone as they were trying to think about and engage on immigration through their faith in a different way.
Am I correct in thinking, you say in the book, that our systems assume that lower skilled, less educated immigrants are of less value, expendable, not part of a family unit, yet we need so many of those workers? I mean, when we look at the aging population in America and a caregiver, I've got to believe that there is so much caregiving going on with the immigrant community of recent vintage, and we're going to need so much more of that. So what is it when people say, well, I want, you know, high-skilled tech workers, but I don't want X, Y, or Z? What are we really hearing in all of that?
You know, when I was working on the book, I found myself gravitating towards this concept of dignity over and over and over again as I was writing. And I came across a particular book written by, I think it was Michael Rosen, and he defined dignity to include three, in essence, elements. One is status. Second is someone's inherent value. And third is someone's behavior that, you know, we see as dignified. And what I realize is that for someone who we see as an undocumented immigrant, a low-skill immigrant, we do not think of them as dignified. We don't give them a legal status. We do not see their contributions as having an inherent value to society. And we believe that their behavior is not dignified. But in reality, and Rosen actually writes this, is that in failing to respect the humanity, or I would say dignity, of others, we actually undermine the humanity in ourselves. And I would argue that we actually undermine our own dignity by stripping immigrants of their dignity. So when this debate is boiled down to high-skill versus low-skill immigrants, I think we are undermining the dignity of people, whether they are working as skilled farm workers or skilled engineers, whether they are legal immigrants or not, whether they are U.S. citizens or not. And that, at the end of the day, undermines the dignity of ourselves and our nation. And these examples that I wrote about in Idaho and Iowa and other parts of the country, I think begin to restore the dignity of the immigrant, the dignity of the American, and hopefully the dignity of our nation.
How do we get at some of the issues that you talked about at the beginning in terms of putting them into balance, that we want safety? And again, there have been many politicians able to scare people that there was an invasion going on in caravans at our border and all these things that in 2018, when that was attempted during the midterms, it definitely did not work. So the question is, when we try to balance safety, economy, and culture, because there is an issue of brown and black people coming across the border that we haven't really touched upon directly, though clearly it's implicit. How do we get those things in balance so that a majority of Americans who recognize that we really have to do something other than what we have been doing can really get around a solution that Congress may be able to put forward?
Well, I think that the example in Idaho is a perfect setting to describe, okay, how do you do this? So in this case, you have a population that has been scared into thinking immigrants and refugees are cultural or racial threats, are security threats, and are economic threats. And the people scaring them are, you know, your Donald Trump or others at a from a very powerful perch, whether it's in politics or in media. So how did you and Southern Idaho say, okay, there's a different way to do this? Look, I will be the first to tell you, it is not going to be an advocate from Washington, D.C. that is going to affect that change in opinion or that change in identity. It is going to be the dairyman who is trusted economically and culturally and socially in Southern Idaho. It's going to be the local police chief or sheriff who is trusted from a security perspective. It is going to be the Catholic priest. It is going to be the evangelical pastor. It is going to be the Mormon elder. There's a large Mormon population in Southern Idaho. All of those leaders need to work side by side with the new immigrants and refugee leaders in Southern Idaho and help this broader community understand that immigrants and refugees in Southern Idaho are integrating into communities and becoming part of our schools, our churches, our workplaces. They are serving as local police officers. They're serving in the armed forces. And ultimately, they are helping the economy of Southern Idaho thrive and prosper. So again, it comes back to those local efforts to create the conversations that address this issue, not from a political perspective, but from a cultural perspective, from a security perspective, and from an economic perspective.
When we see that there are crops that can rot in the field, or that there's work not getting done that needs to get done, or lawns to be cut, or slaughterhouses to be manned. I mean, these are, I guess, things that will get people's attention over time. But you say that policy solutions are the easy part, recognizing the dignity of undocumented people, allowing them to go in as full citizens and creating humane migration system is a lot harder. Where are we along this continuum? If we can't get even the policy stuff so that we can really start to get people to change, sometimes we start with behavior and then attitudes follow. We've seen that during a lot of other civil rights movements. You know, where is America along this continuum?
I think we're in for a long haul. I think that the way this debate has gone, quite frankly, since 2013, and, you know, as people are impacted more by how they see immigration on their television screens or their phone screens, even if that immigration is thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away, it is leading them to a position where they're saying, okay, we need to harden our borders. We need to build walls. You know, as the Pope recently said, we are in an age of walls and razor wire. So number one, I think we've got to figure out different ways for people to understand what migration is, how it needs to be managed around the world, and then ultimately what is their opportunity at a local level to impact change. Because, you know, it's strange working in immigration, right? Because it's very easy to become very pessimistic and kind of a sense of this is not an issue that can ever be addressed or solved. You know, whether it's through writing this book or all the work that we do every single day, you know, we really do think that Americans aspire to be their better selves. So how do we create the opportunities for them to realize their better selves? And immigration is, I think, a big part of that opportunity.
One more canard to end this with. And, you know, I hear, well, you know, my ancestors, they melded so gently into the American fabric, you know, the Statue of Liberty welcoming, and there they came to Ellis Island, and everybody, you know, applauded and wanted them. And yet you can see many motion pictures that will depict that it was a harsh welcome that came for the Irish, the Italians, whomever it might be. And now when we look at it, we hear, well, this group of Latinos, let's say, does not want to become part of the American fabric. They want to keep their own language and custom and such. How do you respond to that?
Number one, I always point to the massive waiting lists that there are around the country in terms of people wanting to learn English. You know, I think that if you talk to any immigrant today who wants to ensure that they have greater economic opportunities, that their children have greater economic opportunities, they see integration and learning English as kind of step number one. Number two, there is a waiting list for folks who want to become U.S. citizens. I think it's above 8 million people now. So those are just two examples of, you know, the kind of demand there is among the immigrant and refugee population to own the American dream, you know, as citizens, as those who really are contributing to and improving and enhancing our culture overall. We also, in kind of providing that answer, also have to understand what are people's frustrations, right? They're frustrated that they've got to press one for English. They're frustrated that, you know, they can't talk to, you know, whoever they're trying to get a service from. And we have to be okay with that anger and that fear and let people articulate it, but then give them opportunities and examples to realize that, you know, the same time they're angry at somebody for not being clear in terms of a service, they're thrilled that they're going to church and their children are getting to know a family from Mexico. So all these, you know, we're a complicated folk, right, as people. So I think we have to be comfortable with those complexities.
Well, I like the fact that you make these things as textured as you do, and that's why I think you have the authority that you can speak with to so many different groups. Ali Noorani, he is the president and the CEO of the National Immigration Forum. If people want to continue to really hear from you and listen to what you are thinking and what you are updating us on, how can they keep in touch with the National Immigration Forum?
So our website at the Immigration Forum is immigrationforum.org. And then the website for the book, and I'm doing a weekly newsletter, is alinoorani.org. So you can go to either of those sites and get more information, poke around, and, you know, please do reach out if you have any questions. And, you know, again, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Oh, thank you. The book is called Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. I thank you so much, Ali, for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you.